in. It's Cinema Squabble, episode number 50.
Ooh.
Pretty nifty, right? Feels patriotic in a way, when in a time and era when we're, I think we should just leave politics out of this altogether.
Probably. It hasn't been my most favorite 11 days in the world.
Isn't that a weird thing?
I know, right?
Man, all right.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, episode 50, let's celebrate it in our own way, shall we?
I agree.
So Cinema Squabble, what do we do? Sarah, we are a number of Seattle's film critics. We have been doing this for years. We have a discussion weekly, daily practically on some weeks, where we sit in a theater, we watch films, we discuss what we've seen. Sometimes we agree, sometimes we disagree, and said, you know what, that would make a good podcast. So here we are, doing this in podcast form.
Exactly.
So, if you want to check us out more, you can find more at cinemasquabble.com. You can also find more of the episodes on iTunes. You can also find them on Stitcher and a few other sources that are escaping my brain off the top of my head. But there you go. Adam Gerke, Sarah Michelle Fetters.
It's just us tonight.
Yeah. And simple enough, do have a special guest, Beth Barrett from Seattle International Film Festival. We'll get to her in just a little bit as well, because she's got something pretty nifty up her sleeve.
That's fantastic.
In the meantime, let us just begin with some of the films that came out last week, because we're in January, which is technically almost about to become February as we're recording this. This is still sort of that weird no man's land where a lot of things get dumped, right?
Kind of, yeah. So the thing about January to remember is that there's like four kinds of movies that come out in January. There's the movies that just get dumped, that the studios have just decided, we want to make a quick buck.
Do it. Get it in here.
There are the horror movies.
Yep.
And some of those are good, some of those are bad. But there's usually a lot of genre-type films that get released in January and February because there's not a lot else out there, and kids tend to flock to those films.
Yep. Monster trucks.
And we end up with stuff that's... Well, that's more the dump. But I mean, but we end up with stuff that varies for like, Bye Bye Man, not so good, or like last week's Split, very good.
Yeah.
You just never know. Right. You get the Oscar nominees. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the potential Oscar nominees, they get released in New York and L.A. over Christmas. And then the rest of the country.
Yeah, we finally catch up with them a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the fourth kind are, and we haven't had one of these in a little while, but the fourth kind of film that gets released in January is the movie that the studio just doesn't know what the heck to do with.
Right.
Like, the most famous example of that is from, I think, 2010, or I have to look it up real quick, but right around there is The Gray with Liam Neeson, if you remember film.
The Wolf film, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was a Joe Carnahan film who was known for, like, The A-Team and Smoking Aces and those kind of movies, and yet The Gray is this, like, almost Malick-esque treatise on life and death and survival. It's like Terrence Malick does Call of the Wild.
Yeah.
Liam Neeson performance, and the studio just had no idea what it was. They didn't know what to do with it, and they just kind of dumped it in January and ended up being on a lot of top 10 lists. And Liam Neeson was legitimately in the Oscar discussion all year, even though the movie was released in January.
Yeah.
So those are usually what you get in January.
Yeah, it's a smorgasbord of a lot of crap often.
Yeah.
But
sprinkled with some good just out of nowhere. I mean, again, Split.
Well,
great.
But let's talk a little bit about A Dog's Purpose, because A Dog's Purpose, where do we file this one? Here's the thing. Okay, A Dog's Purpose came out last week.
Yep.
General gist of this is following a course of reincarnation, right? So you got to subscribe to reincarnation first and foremost. We follow a dog's spirit, which is over the course of its multiple lifetimes. Unlike a cat, which has 9 lives, a dog has just multiple lifetimes as
apparently.
Well. So question a dog's purpose. It's there to question, why am I here? What am I doing? What is going on? And we're seeing this through the eyes of the dog and the various different people of the dog.
It's basically about a half century in this dog's various lives.
Different lives. And along those same lines, we are also given the exposure of one of the owners, a young Ethan, who's either Bryce Geisar, I believe, or Geisar.
Geisar,
And KJ Aha, a little bit older.
Yep.
So it's a young Ethan.
And then 8 and 18.
Right.
10 years, a dog's life.
A 10-year span. 10 to 12 years. And then we catch up with older Ethan, played by Dennis Quaid. So the dog...
Is that a spoiler?
In another incarnation, comes back to Ethan.
Oh, man.
So
that
here
feels
we
like,
are.
That feels like a spoiler.
I don't think it is. I have a feeling, I'm actually pretty sure it's not, because I know in the trailer they even show it.
The trailers kind of give it away.
Yeah. So here's the thing. It's directed by Lassie Wahlstrom, and it's based on the novel of W. Bruce Cameron. And so this is sort of a semi-ecumenical, semi-spiritual look at our furry best friends,
is that
right?
How you pronounce his name? Did you look that up?
I didn't, but I'm just going with it.
I thought it was Lassie.
Could be. Like Mango Lassie?
Yeah, I was
Or Lassie?
Sure.
Lassie? I don't know. It's
okay.
It is European at the to the say the
Lasse
least.
Lasse Hallström was what I thought, because with the never
it's,
mind.
Well, with W's would be Wall, or unless it's this is Germanic, or is this Swedish?
Swedish.
Wallström. Yeah, because okay. The umlaut over the O would make it
Okay.
So
look at that. We're having grammar discussions tonight. Great.
A foreign language, nonetheless.
I know, but you know the thing with Lasse is mm-hmm. you know he is an Academy Award nominated. Winning mm-hmm. director. Mm-hmm. You know, My Life as a Dog is one of the great films of the latter half of the 20th century.
It really is.
Phenomenal. Cider House Rules won a bunch of Oscars. It's very good. Not my favorite of his movies, but it's very good. What's Eating Gilbert Grape? Chocolat.
Yeah.
I mean, he's made some very good movies.
In fact, he's
a great director.
What's Eating Gilbert Grape? She's not here to say this, but our producer Sprints knew the writer of What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
Oh, my goodness. Well, there you go. So, interesting information.
They went to school together. So there you go.
Well, and what I'll say with this is Lasse tries his hardest mm-hmm. to not let this movie drip into the inherent treacle and saccharine nature that is inherent to this story.
Too late.
But I mean, you have to admit, he does try. I mean, because this is a movie where you basically are going to watch a dog die.
Seven times. Yeah.
Which is inherently
melodramatic
and kind of emotionally horrible.
It really is, because the owners don't ever seem to acknowledge the fact that, well,
they don't get the chance. The owners don't. I mean, you do get the one scene when our dog dies the second time. Mm-hmm. And that's the one thing to understand is that when our dog meets Ethan, it's his second life. But Ethan does get a moment to say goodbye where mm-hmm. where the dog sort of gets to acknowledge that.
Right.
But because the entire movie is more or less seen through the canine's point of view, mm-hmm. you don't get to see how the humans react. Which, I mean, in some cases is okay.
On the death end of this.
Yeah, in some cases this ends up being okay. And in some instances, it really is a problem.
Yeah.
And just by the very nature of the story, mm-hmm. and I don't know how it relates back to W. Bruce Cameron's actual book, who's one of the numerous screenwriters that's credited here.
There's six of them overall.
I don't know why it took this many writers, including the author himself, to adapt this, but whatever. But just by the nature of this story, it basically plays like a series of shorts,
mm-hmm.
and some of the shorts are better than the others. I mean, that's just the nature of a movie that is a series of shorts. But there's this one short that is with John Ortiz, the great character actor John Ortiz, as a Chicago police officer.
And this is the one that basically garners the attention of PETA.
Sure. Because there's a heroic moment that people are going to be debating whether the dog wanted to do it, the dog actor wanted to do it, didn't want to do it, was forced into doing it. I'm not going to jump in on that. It does sound like the video was severely edited. Whatever.
Either way.
That short in particular, really well acted.
Yeah.
But freakishly depressing. Because you basically watch a character who has lost everything in his life get attached to something new, in this case our hero, the dog, only to lose, and this isn't a spoiler, because I mean we're talking about a movie here where the dog dies multiple times, so you know the dog is going to die, only to lose that dog.
Yeah.
So you're following a character who keeps losing everything in his life, and you get no bookend to that. You don't know what happened to this character, other than just you have to assume becomes an alcoholic, depressed mess and is just wrecked by it all. But be that here or there, For some, this movie is going to be fantastic. I know our friend Brian Teibel really enjoyed it. There are some dog people that I think are really going to enjoy the film. There are other dog people that are going to hate the movie just by the nature of what it is.
Yeah.
Personally, I did laugh every now and then. I think some of the performances are actually quite good. I think there's some wonderful little moments sprinkled in the movie. It's just so hard to watch a film where you're just being so obviously manipulated every single second.
I felt the cheese whiz dialogue too from the narration Josh Gad provides for the dog in throughout this whole
thing. Who does a better job than I thought he was going to do, to be honest. I mean, the way the narration is written, not so great. But I think Josh Gad actually sells some of it a lot better than I expected him to.
But nonetheless, I still walked away from it going, cheese whiz, I'm up to Velveeta, it's up to my neck. But I mean, I think we both walked away kind of going, surprisingly, this worked. And I remember some of the folks that were in the theater with us when we saw it. This worked surprisingly well for a number of them, where I heard people like moaning of, oh, depression.
Yep.
You know, I thought, well, obviously these are the dog lovers. So this is a hormonal, like, if you've got the hormones, you're going to feel this. You're going to feel the pain.
What I'll say is I think it's beautifully shot by Terry Stacey.
Yeah.
And I think Britt Robertson, if we remember her from like Tomorrowland and some other little movies, that I think she's got a great little supporting role as the girlfriend, Ethan's first girlfriend.
Yeah.
And there's a short involving an African-American couple that is easily the best thing in the entire film, in my opinion. Yeah. It's the only short that works in and of itself.
Yeah. So in a nutshell, are you going theater rent or skip on this?
But see, I am going to still go with, if you are a dog lover and you can get past the fact that you're going to watch the dog die seven times, you are going to go see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you to go see it.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else... I'm even with the stuff that I like, I'm going to say skip because it's just so overtly manipulative. I can't take it.
Okay. All right. And I'm in the rental category.
Well, there you
which
go.
Which is kind of splitting that difference.
So there we split it right there.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about Gold. Now, I was given the impression that Gold is sort of the story that's all over the map, really, as far as it's the story of a Matthew McConaughey's character.
Yeah.
Tell me about this. He's looking for gold. He's scheming for gold. What's the deal?
Gold is loosely based on a true story.
Yeah.
Although all of the characters in the film itself are fictitious.
Okay.
But it's loosely based on a real story that happened in the early 1990s. This movie is set in the late 1980s.
Right.
And
I heard everyone was after the film was going out to Google this person, and then they came up with nothing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But so this movie is about Kenny Wells, played by Matthew McConaughey, who is a Reno, Nevada prospector. He runs a business that they specialize in going out and looking for gold, looking for precious minerals. That's what they do.
This isn't pawning watches.
No,
isn't looking for rings.
These are actual prospectors. And I mean, it's north
to Alaska.
You got it. And it is a business that was founded by his grandfather, you know, half century earlier.
Sure.
Everything's like a half century today. It's so weird.
And it's the 50 show. So
I know. It kind of works out.
50-50.
But, you know, it's a wildly successful business, but it's based on luck in some ways.
Yeah.
And what happens is when he ends up taking over the business after his father dies, and his father's played by Craig T. Nelson, they have a string of bad minds, and suddenly the business is at the end of its rope.
Yeah.
And so... as sort of a last resort, Kenny Wells sells everything he has, pawns his last things of value, and rushes to Indonesia to meet with a geologist named Mike Acosta, who's played by Edgar Ramirez.
Okay.
And Mike Acosta believes that there are hidden gold strikes throughout that region of the world.
Okay.
Based on his study of the geology.
Yeah.
And with his last dollar, Kenny Wells goes, okay, let's find this.
Mm-hmm.
And they do.
Miraculous of all miraculous things.
And it's the greatest gold strike maybe in human history.
Holy smokes.
Everybody freaks out about it. Wall Street freaks. I mean, and so the movie is, one of our fellow Seattle critics sort of nicknamed the movie The Wolf of Gold Street.
So, okay.
Because it really, it sort of becomes a satire about Wall Street, about corporate greed, about all of these other things that are going on. And yet it's also a movie about self-implosion Because we find out later on that the FBI gets involved because there might be something hinky going on. Not everything might be on the up and up. There could be a theft of a, you know, almost $200 million. There's lots of things that are happening within this movie, and it's definitely a satire, and it's definitely a commentary film.
Mm-hmm.
It's from Steven Gagan, mm-hmm. whose last notable film as a director, if you remember, was Syriana, the movie that won George Clooney an Oscar and was a great film. I mean, yes. That movie actually was a wonderful movie.
Mm-hmm.
This movie...
That's a heavy sigh, by the way.
Yeah, well, I mean, so screenwriters Patrick Massett and John Zinman, they're best known for the first Lara Croft Tomb Raider movie.
Oh, so they're...
And I'm not saying that they are not...
They clearly found the top brass to write this story, is what you're saying.
And I'm not saying that that means anything. I mean, you know, if we think about it, Eric Hescher, he went from Lights Out, which I liked, but I mean, he went from Lights Out to writing Arrival.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of cases.
You're right. There are
many examples.
Where people take something here. This is their carrier virus gets them in the door, and then they write something miraculous.
And the screen. I mean, like the screenwriters of Problem Child are the same screenwriters of The People versus Larry Flint.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
And Ed Wood.
Yeah. I can't fault the writer for that.
But this movie does not work.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do they bring it together? Do they sell you on this?
This movie never finds a consistent tone. It wants to be sort of, again, Wolf of Wall Street, but it also wants to be a little bit of Oliver Stone's Wall Street, and it also wants to be a little of that Devil May Care craziness of Werner Herzog's Fitzcarraldo, and it also wants to be a little bit of The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, where, you know, people go insane going after these riches. Yeah. It wants to mix all of these different things into one pot, and Gagan tries, and there are some great moments that he's able to stage, but he just never is able to coalesce all of these elements that are fighting against one another into something that's cohesive, something that you can grab onto and relate to. I will say Matthew McConaughey, and to a lesser extent Edgar Ramirez, but Matthew McConaughey, who, you know, gained like 50 pounds for this movie and is I mean he is all in. He's superb.
Sure. Will they be talking about him come Oscar season next year?
Technically, this is a 2016 release.
Oh, boo.
So, no, they will not be talking about him Oscar season next year because this was...
It's screened released, in New York.
It's screened in New York and LA for Oscar season this year. So, no, it's out.
Okay.
Not going to happen.
Clap, clap. You're out, improviser.
For fans of Matthew McConaughey, Edgar Ramirez, and to a lesser extent, Bryce Dallas Howard, who has a very important small role as... Kenny Wells' longtime girlfriend.
I was going to say love interest,
If you like them, definitely worth a rental. Yeah. And I will say, because the performances are so good and because there are moments that are so nice that I was drawn to, I will go rental.
Okay.
But you are probably going to still be slightly disappointed because you can look at the film and say to yourself, man, this should be so much better.
Should have been. I want my $2.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got you.
It really goes that way.
All right. So Gold getting the rental category. Tell me about, sir, you've caught up with a few of these as well from this.
Well, yeah. I mean, everything from last week.
Julieta being another one. This was, as you were mentioning, this is the offering from Spain that they were hopeful was going to get an Oscar nod.
Well, and why wouldn't they be? It's Pedro Almodovar's new movie, and you can't go wrong with Pedro. If you're Spain, you've submitted a bunch of his films, and almost all of them have either made their way into the Oscar conversation by making the shortlist or have been flat out nominated, and a couple of them have won.
Right.
You know, this is the director of Volver and Talk to Her and Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, after all. So, one of the great directors.
A great one, by the way.
Marvelous movie.
Nutty, some of the visuals that are going in that one, too.
Totally. It's just, if you like Talk to Her, if you like Talk to Her and you liked Volver, and I bring up Talk to Her, Volver, and Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown for good reason, because Julieta is definitely in that vein.
Mm-hmm.
Again, much different film. Every movie Almodovar makes is a different film, which is what I love about Pedro. He just, even when you watch one of his failures, it's still something different and idiosyncratic and nutsy and ballsy and just fun to watch. And again, even if I don't like the movie, I still want to watch the movie.
Right.
This movie, I like.
Mm-hmm.
This movie, I sort of liked when I got done watching it. I liked even more after about a week.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think I'm in love with it.
Okay.
It's based on three short stories from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Munro that the director has sort of crafted into his own sort of seamless three-prong narrative. But it bounces back and forth between time periods, and it revolves around Julieta, uh-huh. who she's an academic. She's an aging academic played by Emma Suarez, who runs into a former best friend of her daughter, mm-hmm. Antia. And this woman, Beatrice, played by Michelle Jenner, tells her, "Hey, I ran into your daughter. She was on the beach with her kids." And what we need to know here is that Julieta hasn't seen her daughter in almost 20 years. Her okay. daughter has basically disappeared. And she did not know whether her daughter was alive, dead, anything.
So
and the reason behind this then takes us backwards to where Julieta meets Antia's father, X-O-A-N.
Ha. Huh.
Yeah.
X-O-A.
It's Spanish.
It's like Oaxaca.
Yeah.
Oh.
Played marvelously by Daniel Grohl. I'll just say that.
Sure.
He's great. But so now we are in the past with a young Julieta played by Adriana Ugarte, mm-hmm. who is also marvelous. Mm-hmm. And we learn about their relationship. And okay. there's a tragedy that's involved there.
So we got a lot going on here.
Yeah.
There's a lot of moving parts.
And it's why Antia, when she turns 18, disappears.
Okay.
So the stuff that happens in the past uh-huh. is important for the stuff that's happening in the present. The movie never gives you a lot of easy answers.
Okay.
The movie never resolves all of the questions or the problems that have arisen throughout its narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it is a wonderful depiction of a woman moving through her life and sort of embracing who she is and what she's become, but also having to reconcile and deal with the past.
Okay.
So
why do you think this did not get the nod for Oscar
over some
of the other submissions?
Well, this year was a tough year to mm-hmm. make the shortlist. I mean, you look at the films that made the Oscar shortlist, and to people that don't know, the Oscar shortlist, what happens is every country submits their own mm-hmm. film for consideration, and then about 4 weeks before the Oscar nominations are announced, there's a short list that gets released, and it's usually 8 to 10 films,
mm-hmm.
And those are the movies that have made the final cut
mm-hmm.
that can be nominated. And this year, Julieta did not make that final cut.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you look at the films we were talking about Isabelle Huppert and mm-hmm. Elle a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago. Elle didn't make the final cut.
Yeah.
And that should tell you all you need to know about the quality of this year's submissions.
Right.
But also, the more challenging your film is,
mm-hmm.
the harder it is sometimes to convince yeah. Oscar voters
which would also make sense why Elle wouldn't make it in there,
exactly.
because Elle is very challenging.
Exactly. And unless you have a gigantic critical push behind you,
mm-hmm.
which is what Germany's Toni Erdmann has.
Screening for us tomorrow.
I've seen it. It's fantastic.
Oh, you did?
Okay. But yes,
yeah.
you are right. It's screening for us tomorrow.
Okay.
But, I mean, that movie had huge critical push. It also had gigantic buzz after it played at the Cannes Film Festival. And so for the Foreign Film Committee,
mm-hmm.
it was a lot easier for them to put that, you know, when you get 90 submissions, mm-hmm. that one goes to the top of your list.
Yeah.
Where the more challenging ones, in the case of like Julieta
right.
or Elle,
yeah.
Those might end up in the middle of the pile.
Yeah.
And if not everybody gets to them, then they don't get nominated. They don't make the shortlist.
Okay, I want you to bookmark that when we get to a little discussion here on Oscars and SAG Awards here coming in a second.
Sounds good.
I got a question about
okay.
that because I'm noticing a pattern here.
Yep.
Not surprising, but
yep.
okay.
But,
so,
I mean, Julieta is, it's still a marvelous movie.
Mm-hmm.
I have not watched all of there were 8 films that made the shortlist this year, and I did not watch all 8 of them. I've seen 4 of them.
Sure.
That's
better than most.
Yeah, the 4 that I've seen are all pretty fantastic, and I get why. I mean, I get why they would not necessarily get picked over this one,
right?
But I can't really get mad at Oscar voters for
sure,
saying
sure.
these four were better.
Yeah.
But Julieta is still a marvelous film for Pedro Almodovar fans. It's a must
uh-huh.
just to watch some fantastic female performances.
Right.
On that level alone. It's a must. I mean, for me, this is a theater. This is a strong theater. It's a movie that just gets better the more I think about it.
Do you know if this is what theaters in Seattle will be picking this one up? This sounds like a SIFF theater, or is this like Sundance?
It was playing at Sundance. It started at Sundance last week, and I can only assume with as popular as Pedro is in Seattle, it's going to be playing for a little while longer. I guess we could look that up, but I haven't done that.
Okay.
But it should be here for a little while.
But a smaller theater, more boutique-ish, shall we
say. Yes, it's not... You know, not getting, especially with it not getting an Oscar nomination, it's not going to have it's not going to be out there very long.
Okay. Brings us to Resident Evil. Now,
Resident Evil, the final chapter.
Hold on.
Okay.
This is to quote Red Letter Media, which is to say, this is the fifth or sixth in a series put together by the director whose sole purpose is to keep his wife employed.
That's unfair.
Now, in this particular one, this is which one's Resident Evil? Is this
based on the video game?
Is this Kate or is this
Mila?
This is Mila. Mila Jovovich. Okay, so she wears black leather and kicks things again.
Well, and just kind of like Underworld, where they wear black leather and kick things.
Brought to us by the good folks at Sony.
Yeah, both films, both series are brought to us by the good folks at Sony.
Okay, but.
So unlike Underworld, you know, I have a soft spot for the Underworld films because they are all of a consistent quality.
Right.
They're not great, but they're fun, and they're... You,
vampires and werewolves.
And Kate Beckinsale is a blast in them, and you know what you're getting into with each one of those films.
Right.
They don't ever aspire to be great, but they're not bad. They're just, if you're in the right frame of mind, they're enjoyable, and the action's usually good, and they're fun.
Is this
the Resident Evil films, which are based on the video game series, has got to be one of the most wildly inconsistent, long-running series of films that I have ever seen, as far as post-apocalyptic zombie horror action hybrids are concerned.
Yeah.
Not that there's a lot of those. But, I mean, some of the movies are fun.
Uh-huh.
And some of the movies are just almost to the point they're unwatchable. They're so bad. They're just terrible.
Yeah.
And four of the six have been directed by Mia's husband, Paul W.S. Anderson, who has made the two best films in the series, but he's also made the two
worst.
Well, no, he made. Right. Nah, that's not true because the second one is. Maybe still the worst one, but he made maybe the worst one because the fifth one was pretty bad.
Okay, so this is the sixth.
This is the sixth.
Okay,
this is the sixth. It's the final chapter.
So they say,
and it's where Alice has to go back to where it all began in Raccoon City and discover about her past and who she was and she learns that there's an actual cure for the T virus that will help save the world. Yada yada yada. It's the best ones. The first Resident Evil, made in 2002, is still probably the best video game. Not that this is like high praise.
Nobody's going back to watch these films.
But the Resident Evil, the first Resident Evil, is probably the best video game adaptation ever made.
Okay,
and it's good. It's enjoyable. It's fun.
Right.
This one is the best one since that one.
Okay,
it's fun to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
It's really dumb.
Mm-hmm.
There are moments where Anderson stages some fantastic action, and then there's also some moments where he stages what should be fantastic action, but it's cut so haphazardly, you have no idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. There's this long, extended martial arts battle in the middle of the movie between Mila and South Korea superstar Lee Joon-ji that should be all kinds of fantastic. I mean, it's the two of them. They're on top of this like tank thing.
There's too much going on, though.
And it's chopped to the point where you cannot see
what Lee is doing.
Yeah, yeah. And this is one of the best martial artists of our time. And he's just made to where you can't tell what he's doing. But you know what? I checked my brain at the door.
Yeah.
I am not a W.S. Anderson hater. I think sometimes he can make decent enough genre. I mean, he's a B director from the Roger Corman school.
Yeah.
And I feel like sometimes he makes movies that I just enjoy. There was enough in this one that I enjoyed that I'll tell people to rent it.
Okay.
But if you're not a fan of the series, obviously just stay away.
Do you ever think there will be like we were joking about how XXX and Fast and Furious, those universes could collide.
Sure.
Do you ever think there could be a collision between Resident Evil and Underworld? No. I mean, because these are...
It would be too hard.
Weren't near the same thing
One, I mean, but one is like a post-apocalyptic world with zombies, and the other one is like a modern world with werewolves and vampires. I mean, it would...
Just a line of dialogue could easily make this come together. Look, the werewolves and the zombies have all merged.
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
Okay.
Let's just not go
but
there.
But there's a rental. Okay, so yeah. Resident Evil getting a rental. Hey, there's some pretty exciting stuff coming up here with Seattle International Film Festival. In fact, so joining us in studio, Beth Barrett from Seattle International Film Festival. Beth, you are the interim artistic director for Seattle International Film Festival. And we should point out that Seattle International Film Festival, I mean, that typically happens as we get closer in towards spring and summer, but you've got stuff going on year-round.
Absolutely. We are a 365-day-a-year organization. So we do have the 25-day festival in May and June. Mm-hmm. This year it's May 18th to June 11th.
Mark your calendars now.
Exactly. But the other 340 days of the year, we have CIF Cinema, both at the Uptown and at the Egyptian and the Film Center, which is our flagship office on Seattle Center.
And so coming up here very soon, Noir City.
Noir City. We're so glad to have Eddie Muller back. He is the czar of noir. Right. He's the founder of the Film Noir Foundation, and he's been doing it for a number of years in San Francisco at the Castro Theater.
Sure.
And about 10 years ago, he brought it up to Seattle. We've known Eddie for a long, long time. And so we relaunched it last summer at the Egyptian, which is a perfect place to see noir films. And it went so well, we decided to go back to the winter when it was a much more noir-y season.
And a question for the layperson who's not familiar with what noir film is. I mean, you and I, we get it. But somebody who's going, I don't know, is this gumshoes? Is this detectives? Is this black and white? Is this color? I mean, give us an understanding of what noir film or how your vision of noir film is.
Yeah, so classic film noir is generally like 1940s, 1950s, Edward R. Murrow, black and white. You know, the bombshell dame somehow crisscrosses everyone and
it
turns
was a
on
dame,
everyone.
Two dames.
There's
no
a couple
wait.
Of guns and generally somebody, you know, gets shot, usually by the bombshell dame.
Yeah.
You know, here and there. But it's this
and
sort of
I'm thinking muted trumpets too.
Absolutely. Some great soundtracks from the classic 50s noir.
Yeah.
But it was really kind of in a reaction. All these films kind of came out of a reaction to the 1940s and World War II and this sort of like deep, dark underpinning. You know, the gangsters were on the rise in the mobs and in New York and Chicago. And there's this just like anxiety that came through the noir. And all the old good detective stories have this element of noir and somebody done somebody wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so those were really the big films of the 1950s.
Yeah. And so this go around, we've got how many films? This is 20 films or 20 plus? Or are we looking at, I see you're counting here through the entire program.
20 films this year.
Solid 20 films. And important to point out, I mean, you've got films that are stretching from the 50s and the 60s and 70s, but there's even modern film that falls into the film noir category here too.
Absolutely. So Eddie Muller program, the program is Noir City, and he takes us around to a different city pretty much after starting in February. Every month he's in somewhere else in the U.S., which is amazing. And this year's theme is the art of the heist.
Mm-hmm.
And so the heist, that genre is so central to film noir in the 50s. You know, somebody steals something and that's the central action. And so he wanted to look at what that feeling and what that interpretation was over many, many years. So we definitely have some 50s, some great 50s, some that are not seen as often, like Kansas City Confidential, and The League of Gentlemen is not seen very often at all. So there's some real classics, some rarities in there. But then how did that affect the films of the 60s and 70s, especially like The Taking of Pelham 123, And the classic French noir, Rififi. I mean, that is like the classic French noir. But even up unto Sexy Beast, you know, Ben Kingsley and Sexy Beast, that is a classic noir film. It's just
and
from
it's only, it's,
2004.
Yeah, it's only a couple years old here.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So you definitely spread the gamut over here over 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
So this is impressive. I thought I saw one also that was from, here's the aura. It's saying 2005 on that here in this. So, I mean, really stretching an amazing gamut here. what are some of them that are standing out to you as like the, like all of these, of course, are going to be must-sees, but if there's, if you had to pick like a handful, like if you had five, your top five out of this whole bunch, or even less than, I don't know, what would you choose? Like if you were, because this is a great lineup here.
It's a fantastic lineup. So I would definitely catch The Asphalt Jungle, which is the opening night. It's going to be very exciting. People mm-hmm. come really dressed to the nines.
And that's Thursday the 2nd, Thursday the 16th here of February.
Yep. Okay. Exactly. The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, uh-huh. classic, great, great film. And you don't get to see Sexy Beast on 35mm very often right. anymore. And so we're really, really thrilled to be able to show that. And then one of the ones that I think is the most interesting is the last one we're showing, Victoria. It's a 2014 German film, all done in one shot. It's a little over 2 hours long, but it just, it takes you and it just immerses you in this heist gone wrong feeling, and like everybody gets pulled in and
sure.
you know, everybody's loyalties turn at some point. It's just, it's a fantastic way to close out the festival. But I will say every single one of these films is mm-hmm. worth seeing for Eddie Mueller's introduction.
Ah.
He has so much knowledge. He is truly the Czar of Noir. He knows everything about every single one of these films. But the things that he chooses to talk about aren't the necessarily the big level things. One, I remember one introduction very vividly 4 or 5 years ago that he spent talking about one of the lead actress's nose jobs that
oh,
she
really?
Had midway through, and then the whole history of that, and she ended up marrying like her ex-husband's son, and this whole like back and forth of all these things. But all I could do through the entire film was stare at that woman's nose and try to figure out like, okay, well, when's the nose job?
Yeah,
it was amazing.
So, and you're able to, and you are able to see it then when actually you're watching
absolutely.
On camera.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. It's an amazing feeling of knowing something about the film that you wouldn't know
right.
just by general. You know, internet research, because he knows.
He's
literally written the book on film noir.
The encyclopedic knowledge
exactly.
of Eddie.
Exactly.
How did Seattle International Film Festival catch up with him in the first place? I mean, he's been on the scene for a while, but do you recall where this all, like, where lines crossed and where everyone got together?
Absolutely. So we had a programmer with us for a long time named Anita Manga, mm-hmm. and she's also on the board of the Film Noir Foundation. She's actually now the executive director of the Silent Film Festival in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and the two of them work really closely together.
Uh-huh.
So she introduced us to Eddie back when Eddie was just doing it at the Castro and was thinking, well, maybe there are other cities that I could go to and,
sure.
and you know, spread the noir gospel.
Sure, sure. And here we are now.
Here we are.
So we've got a whole slew of them, and this runs basically the 16th through the 22nd. So SIFF.net has all the details for Noir City, and the theme being heists, holdups, schemes gone awry. All right. Well, Beth Barrett from Seattle International Film Festival, what also on the docket for you coming up very soon? This is the big one we're looking at right now, but yeah. I know there's a number of other things you guys have in the works coming up here.
Oh, we've got things going on constantly at mm-hmm. the Uptown. This weekend, we're actually opening Raoul Peck's documentary, I Am Not Your Negro,
mm-hmm.
which is an excellent, excellent documentary, just nominated for an Academy Award. We'll be showing the Academy Award-nominated short films, live action animation, over at the Uptown. And then we've got a number of things coming up for February, March, and April.
Yeah.
Leading into, of course, the Seattle International Film Festival. Where passes are on sale right now.
Fantastic. And I know that also at the Uptown recently, there have been screenings of La La Land for people who wanted to catch up with
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
Looking
La
like
La Land and Moonlight. 20th Century Women is moving over there on Friday.
All the
Egyptian.
All the films that right now seem to be kind of the front runners and the ones to catch up with.
Absolutely.
So, very cool. Well, Beth, thank you very much for dropping by
Thanks,
with us.
Thanks, Adam.
So there you go, Noir City, Seattle International Film Festival. Sarah, you've had a chance to look through the program here.
Heck yes.
Anything jumping out at you? Rafifi, to me, is one that is on my list of hits.
Rafifi is one of the great heist movies of all time. If
right.
you've never seen it, you need to see it. And
yeah.
that plays on Monday, February 20th at mm-hmm. 1:30. And, you know, call in sick, have a fake doctor's appointment, whatever you got to do,
yeah.
go to that movie.
She was also suggesting Victoria, which is one of your favorites you were mentioning.
Yeah, well, I mean, that movie almost made my top 10 last year, if you remember. It's from 2015, but it's a Sebastian Schipper film that uh-huh. was released in the U.S. in 2016, and it's 2 hours and 20 minutes, and it's all one take.
I want to pick your brain, because
I've seen almost all of these, actually.
But for folks who are looking to get their feet wet and get a good, you know, understanding of what film noir is about, where do you come in on this?
If you are going to watch one to just learn what old school gotta see it, gotta know what it is, film noir is.
Yeah.
I either want to go with Crisscross with Burt Lancaster.
Uh-huh.
It's a Robert Siodomak classic that is just unbelievably good, but it just drips in noir goodness.
Right.
Or I want to go with Kansas City Confidential, which is one that a lot of people don't know of, but it's the film that inspired Reservoir Dogs.
Sure.
It is as essential to noir as any movie you are likely to see.
Okay, so Crisscross is on the 16th.
Yes.
Kansas City Confidential is on the 17th.
Go.
More information, you can find it at cif.net. A few things to talk about here have happened since we last had a chance to actually kind of meld the minds here. SAG Awards happened. Yep. Not really too surprising in anything that we saw there.
No, I mean, but Hidden Figures. Hidden Figures winning the ensemble was a little bit of a surprise because
was not a surprise.
It wasn't a surprise to me, but I think to most it was a little bit of a surprise because a lot of people felt like Moonlight had that in the bag. Only because Moonlight is the year's most acclaimed film.
Right.
But Hidden Figures becoming the box office juggernaut that it has, and also just, it is a true ensemble. I mean, and that movie, it's the kind of film that actors are just going to fall over themselves falling in love with. So personally, it didn't surprise me a lot, but I know a lot of people were surprised. And they also kind of feel like that win could propel it to maybe doing something at the Oscars.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
The Oscar nominations were as expected and also not as expected.
Right.
And I will give my whole I told you so about Best Actress. I told you that was going to be crazy.
But fun in the fact that we weren't surprised, but we were surprised in that. And you were saying, though, that, I mean, from the get-go, you said, look, there are 16 people that could be in this category right now.
Yep, and two of them showed up that I talked about.
So, that just shows you how wide open that really was.
Yeah, but I mean, I think you and I were talking about this earlier, but I think the more amazing part of it was I was saying that if there were going to be people that were slighted, it was going to be Amy Adams for Arrival, which I know a lot of people are completely upset about, and she's genius in Arrival. I feel for her, but I felt like if people were going to get slighted, it was going to be her, and I actually thought it was going to be Isabelle Huppert for Elle, and it was our screener discussion. I mean, it was just a case of who is going to put that movie at the top of their screener list, and I thought she was the one that was going to get slighted. I did not expect it to be Annette Bening.
Yeah.
That is the one that surprises me.
Yeah. I was a little hurt by that one myself.
But it's hard for me to get mad that like Ruth Negga from Loving is in this because she's genius in Loving and she deserves to be here.
Yeah.
And everybody getting angry about Meryl Streep. Mm. Meryl Streep is fantastic in Florence Foster Jenkins.
Yeah.
But after her Golden Globe speech for her Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yeah.
She was getting in.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the nomination ballots went out that very week that she made that speech.
No kidding.
So right after she made that speech, she was getting nominated.
Okay. Okay. I see that. Now, I want to go back to the bookmark that I said, File in Your Brain, talking about hard films to palate, right?
Yeah.
So we're talking about the foreign films being hard to palate, and sometimes it's the lighter ones are the ones that kind of percolate to the top. I'm wondering about Manchester by the Sea, because that was a weighty, heavy film, strong performances all around, but I'm wondering if it's perhaps getting dumped to the bottom of the pile because so many people are going, oh, I hear it's so depressing, and therefore it's getting completely snubbed. What are your thoughts?
I don't know if it'll get completely snubbed. Mm-hmm. I do think it still has a chance to win. I think it still has a chance to win screenplay, although my guess would be La La Land is going to win that.
Yeah.
But I would guess it still has a chance to win screenplay because it's an original screenplay and La La Land is its only competition there. The other three are just happy to be there. Casey Affleck and Denzel Washington are your two front runners for Best Actor.
Yeah.
The problem for Manchester by the Sea is the Casey Affleck problem. Yeah. Casey Affleck is brilliant in the movie. Yeah. He deserves to be in consideration to win the Oscar. He has other issues that are affecting him as far as whether people will vote for him or not. Yeah. And they are not the same issues, but they are similar to the issues that Nate Parker had when we were talking about Birth of a Nation earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, it is very likely he is going to lose Best Actor to Denzel Washington.
Yeah.
Now, personally, I think Denzel Washington, of the five people that are nominated for Best Actor, and that's Casey Affleck, Andrew Garfield for Hacksaw Ridge, mm-hmm. Ryan Gosling for La La Land, and Viggo Mortensen for Captain Fantastic, mm-hmm. of that five, I think Denzel Washington gave the best performance.
I was going to say, I'm thinking Denzel. I think this is Denzel, and I think it's Victoria again. I mean, I don't think there's going to be a real surprise. But we'll dig into
Oscars
later.
Exactly, and we'll dig into that in the next show.
Yeah. Also wanted to make mention of the fact that there are not a lot of films this week that we're discussing.
No.
But you noticed a peculiar thing going on here.
Well, I mean, so like one of the movies that's opening this week that we have not had the chance to see yet mm-hmm. is Rings, which is the long-coming sequel to mm-hmm. Ring and Ring 2. Ring, which is fantastic film.
Originally directed by Gore Verbinski.
Exactly. Originally directed by Gore Verbinski, a remake uh-huh. of the Japanese horror film, but yep. still fantastic. I mean, great movie. Rings 2, not so hot, but whatever. Mm-hmm. But we are seeing, so we're not really seeing that one this week.
Right.
Which is usually a big red flag, screening the same night as Rings. Exactly. So they did schedule a last second thing for us to see Rings, uh-huh. but on Thursday night, the night it actually opens,
yep.
but screening against that is A Cure for Wellness, which is
Gore Verbinski's latest film,
yeah. which ironically is also a horror movie.
Yeah.
His first horror movie since the original Ring.
How about that?
I know, right?
It's coincidence.
Very ironic. It's kind of funny. So Adam and I are going to be seeing Cure for Wellness.
sorry, Rings, but that's the way that crumbles.
Yeah.
You working on anything else right now about now?
I actually interviewed Katie Sackhoff today for a little low-budget indie horror film called Don't Knock Twice, which is a lot of fun. But we talked about
that movie.
We talked about Longmire. We talked about Battlestar Galactica.
We even
talked about Halloween Resurrection. We talked about... As crummy as the last 11 days have been, Katie Sackhoff made me feel good to be alive.
All right.
I loved that interview. So that'll be up a little bit later.
She's Canadian, though, right? So I think she is. I'm not. Don't quote me on that.
No wonder she made me happy to be alive.
There you go.
But just a joy.
Okay. And so, Katie, and anything else?
I have an Oscar commentary article that's going to be in the Seattle Gay News.
Okay.
And then that's about it for right now. Oh, I will say... February 21st, I will be a part of a panel with Beth Barrett talking about the Oscars over at the Sorrento Hotel at 7 p.m. So Sorrento Hotel, 7 p.m., Beth Barrett, me, two other people, we're going to be talking Oscars.
Sounds swanky. Well, this has been Cinema Squabble, episode number 50. Thanks much for tuning in, taking a listen. Thanks much to Beth Barrett for joining us earlier. And also thanks much to Sprints Arbogast, our producer.